Yes, sometimes songs come together in ways that are unexpected. Songs that come together because basically one artist learned from another, was influenced by another, stole from another. That sometimes, that's a line. It's a line that has to be decided who crossed what. Well, I'm not necessarily an expert on that, but I do have someone who is on the telephone with us in the neighborhood. He's a fellow who wrote a book called Sounds Like Teen Spirit, about stolen melodies, ripped off riffs. A fellow named Tim English. And Tim, you there with us?
Good evening, Dave. How are you?
Oh, good. Good to hear from you. I'm great, and thanks so much for being with us in the neighborhood. And thanks for writing this book about something that we've all thought about and talked about, but it's great that someone codified this and got together these lists of songs where you put the two of them together and you go, whoa, you know, was this intentional? And was it an homage or was it something more? Well, what gave you the idea to do it?
Well, it's an idea that I'd had for, I guess, probably over 20 years back when I was back in college, and I always thought it would be a neat idea. Whenever I talked to my friends about music, you know, I thought it was a topic that people were really interested in, if people were really into rock and roll and music in general, and nobody else had ever done it, and I had sort of done a little writing on music in my high school and college days, and so I started putting the book together over really many years, and during that time I'd pop into the Barnes & Noble and see if anybody else had come up with the idea. And if they had, I would have just thrown in the towel, but nobody ever did, so there it is.
Now, in how often when you come up, and one of the things that you did was when you go on these radio shows to push the book, you would put together this whole list and these CDs of these things, and there's about 100 examples, which means like 50 songs that are either the sources and then 50 other songs that are outgrowths, let's say. How many would you say are out-and-out theft, and how many would you say are just more like, well, yes, the artist is obviously acknowledging a previous song, but he isn't really stealing it, he's just winking and using it, which is, I think, what the Beatles did with the Chuck Berry number.
Well, the Chuck Berry number is an interesting case. To answer your question in general, I think a lot of this is just influence, of who influenced who. In the book, I can only say that this song sounds like another one, and then I try to provide the background on it as to whether the person that was influenced by, you know, say, song B and song A, whether the guy did song B could have heard it, what was the background, what were the connections, that type of thing. I can't claim to be inside of anybody's head to see this is their intention, that they said, I'm just going to steal this. Or it was, you know, in the case of George Harrison, My Sweet Lord, the judge ruled it was a subconscious plagiarism, but that doesn't get you off the hook for it either. In the case of the one we just heard, You Can't Catch Me and Come Together, John kind of left himself open for that in a way, because he gave an interview, I believe it was to Rolling Stone, and he said that he had, one of the ways that he would write his songs would be sort of like jamming on one song and singing it and sort of playing the groove of that and then trying to come up with his own song. And he admitted that he had done that with the Chuck Berry song, You Can't Catch Me, and in composing Come Together. And, of course, he carried over some of the lyrics, too, like about the flat top and so forth. And the song does have some melodic and rhythmic similarities, but they're still, to me, and John would have said that they're still very different.
They're very different, but then again, it's a Lennon and McCartney song. It's not a Lennon McCartney Berry number.
That's right. But he did apparently come to an agreement in settling the case where he agreed that he would record three of the songs of, I think it was called Big Seven, Berry's publisher. See, a lot of this is not the actual artists, it's just the publishers and the lawyers involved in these things. That was the case with the publishers of who brought suit against George Harrison. The publishers of He's So Fine, the actual writer of that song, was long dead at that time. So it's just the publishing people, you know, getting involved and, you know, the lawyers getting involved and so forth.
Do you remember the, were you around, I don't know how old you are, how old are you?
I'm 46.
So yeah, you would remember when that was really in the papers. And it was a big deal. People were really talking about it, and you know, how did you feel about it back then as a young man?
I thought that's really the kind of first case of this that I remember, and I think it's probably still the most famous case. And I just thought it was intriguing to hear the two songs, and you sort of have an aha moment where you, you know, hear the similarities for yourself. And I thought that they were quite similar.
How would you have voted if you were on the jury? Was there a jury, or was it just a judge saying?
I think the judge decided it. Some of these get in front of juries, and some of it get in front of the judge. But the judge basically said that the whole song had been plagiarized subconsciously.
Well, the melody really kind of, I mean, you know.
Definitely does.
Yeah, I would have given something to the dead guy's family. Just something.
Yeah, well, the thing is, when doing the book, I tried to explain the, you know, copyright infringement law just a little bit and keep it to a merciful minimum. This whole case, you could almost write half a book on it itself because it went on for years and years in the courts. There was sort of, George claimed that there was shenanigans going on behind the scenes with his manager at the time, Alan Klein, sort of negotiating behind George's back. He claimed to purchase the rights of Bright Music while this case was going on, so he was kind of playing two sides at the same time. That sort of colored the case and kept it in the courts for many years. George actually ended up owning the publishing to He's So Fine shortly before he died.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. So in other words, he would have had the right to use it because he would have owned the song anyway.
Yes.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I mean, well, I guess then, like, technically, when he owned the Beatles stuff, Michael Jackson could have, in some ways, plagiarized Beatles songs, and he would have been legally entitled to do so?
I'm not that familiar with the Michael Jackson case of whether he owned the, you know, the different types of publishing things. I think probably would have had some, he did use some of the songs in,
Commercials, of course, right.
At like Revolution, which people didn't really appreciate very much.
Although now so many, I mean, it's just such an epidemic with Bob Dylan shilling for everything and Stone Song cropping up everywhere and David Bowie, his own brand. I think that sounds a little, you know.
Strange, though. I mean, as a friend of mine said to me, he says, well, the Stones sold out years ago.
Oh, yeah.
Stones had Jovan, I think it was their 82 tour, they had Jovan, whatever that was,
or something. Yeah, right.
Sponsoring the thing, so they were way ahead of the curve. Don't forget, Mick Jagger went to London School of Economics.
He's no
dummy when it comes to these deals. And I think times have changed though, because it's so hard for somebody like Mellencamp or Petty to get their new music played these days. That, you know, they put it in a you know, truck commercial or whatever, and why not?
Or in a sitcom or a comedy drama on TV. That's a real great way. Now that people are doing it, just to have it backing some scene, or to, you know, if you can end the CSI with a song, that song's going to sell, you know, whatever, however many tens of thousands of copies the next week.
Yep.
But the one thing that you didn't mention about the George Harrison case, and we'll get on to some other ones, but the thing that struck me as most funny when I was talking to you earlier this week was his defense had to do with the fact that he wasn't just doing... He was not copying He's So Fine. Now, he came up with a song, it was his song, and yet he kind of alluded to or admitted to copying another song.
Well, in his defense, that was something that he had said. And really, one of the things in actually trying to defend the case that they said, though, was that Billy Preston had recorded the song My Sweet Lord. Billy Preston was really involved in the genesis and the creation of the song, I believe. So he doesn't have a writing credit on it, but he recorded the song early in 1970, and his recording of it was produced by George, and it came out, I think, about 6 months before George's recording came out, and it was not a hit. And in defending the case, George's lawyers said, hey, his version, George's version of My Sweet Lord was a hit because this guy was a member of the most successful and famous group in the world, and it was not those three notes or the melody of the Chiffon song that made it. It was the fact that this guy was an ex-Beatle and very popular, and I witnessed the fact that Billy Preston recorded a similar version, and it was not a hit. So that was one of the things they said in trying to defend it. But George also said later that he was actually that he actually had based the song on the Edwin Hawkins singer's hit, Oh Happy Day.
And it's that really blew my mind. I mean, that wouldn't have struck me immediately the way He's So Fine would. When you think about, oh, I don't have a copy of it here, but it's, oh, happy day, oh, happy day, oh, happy day. It is a call and response kind of a thing.
Well, and yeah, they do get into that, though, at the end of the song. And an interesting thing, I believe I'm correct, that the Edwin Hawkins singers sang on the Billy Preston version of the song, My Sweet Lord, that was produced. So I've actually never heard that song. I'd sure like to hear it, though.
It's
I don't think
really incestuous. I mean, well, I don't know, maybe commercial, I can I'll play it later. But it's a very catchy. I used to have that 45, and it's a pretty neat and catchy kind of a pop gospel number.
And just to wrap it up, if you saw the concert for George, it was recorded in London's Royal Albert Hall in 2002, the memorial concert for George Harrison. Really, the showstopper was Billy Preston singing My Sweet Lord. Just a wonderful version of that, and of course he's since passed away.
And the other thing I can remember from the trial, and I don't remember what the other song was, but in trying to prove that songs can be alike but completely different, he played something on the piano. I think it was George himself who played something on the piano, and it might have been Silent Night. He was playing the same notes. It was like the same 13 notes, and when he played the same 13 notes in order but at a different tempo, it was Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Does that ring a bell? It was like, da 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 da. I could be confusing the two songs, but it was like another mind-blowing moment.
I don't recall that, but I do quote George in the book as saying that I can't understand why there are not a million cases of like this in the court. Why is it just this one? That there are every song, you hear lots of songs on the radio that sound like something else.
Well, let's get to some more songs, and some of them that you mentioned in your book, Sounds Like Teen Spirit, which is, by the way, who publishes it, and where can people get it?
Well, it was by iUniverse in a Star Edition. It's available in just about all the bookstores, and if you go to my website, soundsliketeenspirit.com, you have a link up there to Amazon. You can also purchase it on Barnes & Noble or any of the other Books a Million, any of the other websites.
Sounds Like Teen Spirit by Tim English. And so let's get to another one. Here's someone who generally does covers of songs. That's what he is known for. Rod Stewart does song covers, and it says there's no plagiarism there. He has the rights, and he does his versions of songs that are more generally slick and poppy than original. So he'll cover a Tom Waits number, or he'll cover a Beatles number, or a Van Morrison song. Okay. But every once in a blue moon, old Rod has, I don't know, pushed the envelope a little bit. One of the examples of that you mentioned in the book is, his very, very famous hit disco song, Do You Think I'm Sexy? And so we're going to hear a little bit of that. And then what are we going to hear?
I'm going to hear a song called Taj Mahal by the Brazilian artist George Ben. If people do know him in this country, they know him as the author of Mascanada, which was a famous sort of bossa nova song in the 60s. Recorded by Ella Fitzgerald and Sergio Mendez. And one of the things I might say before we hear this
sure.
is that in writing this book, one of the great things about it for me was that I got turned on to a lot of new artists for the first time, including people like George Ben. He's been around for about 45 years and really, really great stuff. If you're into, if you're not into it, you could get into it, Brazilian bossa nova type stuff. And that was, I hope that in reading the book, people will likewise get into some new music for the first time.
Well, here's some old music by Rod Stewart and a little bit of even older music by George Ben. I think you will be able to hear the similarities. Now, was there ever kind of a court case about this, or is it just one of those things where, George Ben was just happy Rod Stewart acknowledged his melody?
There's a little more to it than that.
Okay, what?
As you can see, this one is, there are certain of the examples in the book where I just wonder how there never was a court case, but this one there was. And getting the details on some of these court cases, Dave, is a little murky because a lot of times they're sort of covered up or swept under the rug at some point. But in this case, he did initiate legal action, and it was moving apparently through the courts as Do You Think I'm Sexy was kind of riding high in the charts. It was the number one hit in this country and a lot of other countries. And Rod Stewart said, I'm going to donate my royalties, songwriting royalties from this song to UNICEF. And he did so at a televised concert in January 79 from the UN.
Yeah.
And I found an interview with George Benn from recently, I think about 2 or 3 years ago, and he said what did he think about this whole incident? And he said, well, I'm very glad that the song is going to assist the poor children of the world through UNICEF, but it would have been nice if I had a say in it before somebody had just given away my royalties, rightfully due to me. So kind of mixed feelings there.
How about some of that money could have gone into the George Benn Fund?
Yeah.
The Feed the Bossa Nova Singer Fund. Why not? And it's not the only time that Rod Stewart has played a little bit fast and loose with his sources and with taking rather wholesale melodies from other places. Here's another song that you thought of that you came up with. It's called The Death of Georgie. There's
Killing
two parts
of Georgie, I think it is.
Oh, is it The Killing of Georgie? I'm sorry, you're right. I think you're right about that. It's another song where he's got this out because it's a song about tolerance. It's about this kid who's gay, and he gets killed over it, and how sad that is, and why can't we all live together? So you want to be on Rod Stewart's side of this.
And in fairness, and I do point out in the book, you're exactly right, there weren't that many people even today, and this was, I think, 76, and it was sort of you have to give Rod Stewart credit, sort of a brave thing to record a song with that theme at that time.
So here's the first part of the song. That's the opening part. That's the part one of The Killing of Georgie. So, okay, I mean, that's I can't think of really any other song that he's really taking from. The doo-doo-doos, I mean, Lou Reed was taking the doo-doo-doos from all the 1950s R&B he was listening to. So, okay, fair play.
Those doo-doo-doos sound a little bit different from the Walk on the Wild Side. It's the same ballpark, I would say, though.
But now dig the second part of The Killing of Georgie. This sounds, the beat, it's almost like it is another song. In fact, it is another song.
And it fades back in.
Was there any legal action on that one?
No, things I saw reference that was in John Lennon's, I think it was his Playboy interview recorded right before he was killed. He mentions Rod Stewart's song. They don't really, I think they kind of messed up in the way they quoted them because they sort of referenced Maggie May as being similar to Don't Let Me Down. I'm almost positive that he was referencing this song because he mentioned Don't Let Me Down. And he said, and this is a song that sounds exactly note for note like it. And he said, oh, Rod, that Rod Stewart song. And he said, the lawyers never noticed that one, but he noticed it. And somebody asked me the question, Dave, in one of my interviews recently. They said, well, did the Beatles ever sue anybody? They've gotten sued so much. And I can't recall a case where they have. There are quite a few where they could have or should have.
Right.
Recently, Paul McCartney mentioned the TLC song Waterfalls, said he thought that had ripped off his kind of obscure song Waterfalls from 1980.
Bells. The two songs are both called Waterfall? Wow.
Yeah, Waterfalls.
Okay.
The first two lines are quite similar, but after that, it's not too similar, but it's worth noting. I do have that case in the new edition of the book. And this song by the band Offspring from a few years ago called Why Don't You Get a Job? This is one of those cases where I just can't believe there hasn't been legal action. It's really very, very close to the Beatles' Obladi Oblada, but I haven't heard of any legal action in that case.
Now, one of the weirdest, and in some ways, I don't know, not almost poignant examples that you have. This is probably the weirdest one of all, and it's still, I guess because the Beatles are so world famous, and their music is such a part of the lexicon, like everything they do is subject to this kind of theft and scrutiny and osmosis that we've been talking about.
And because they were so successful, as we said, you know, these suits get attracted when there's money to be made off of it, as in the case of My Sweet Lord. And
John Lennon's Imagine. Now, but this is beyond, this is already to the point of really creepy sort of oddness, but also touching in an odd way. Tell this story that involves John Lennon's 1971 song, Imagine, and a song that came 6 years earlier.
Well, one of the things I tried to do in the book is not only have the cases that would be obvious to sort of a casual fan, maybe like My Sweet Lord and the Ghostbusters, I Want a New Drug case, but also have some surprises in there for the person that's really into music, the music geeks of the world, as you and I are.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm talking myself as a music geek. Thank you very much. Yes.
Yeah, well, the guy introduced me that way, and I said, well, I guess I can't argue with it. But this is certainly the story of John Lennon's father is kind of in this record that he recorded is a very obscure chapter of the Beatles story, but make a long story short, Alfred Freddie Lennon abandoned John and his family when John was about 2 years old. John did not, he was a merchant seaman. John did not see him for many, many years. In the meantime, he had, was raised by one of his aunts and, his mother had been killed when John was a teenager. So really kind of a tragic, upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
His father, reappeared on the scene in 1964, when John and the Beatles were filming Hard Day's Night, and this kind of disheveled figure in need of a bath and missing a few teeth showed up on the set and saying he was John's father. And I think the story goes that John was kind of embarrassed at that time and sort of sent him on his way. A few months passed, and Freddie was peeling potatoes at a hotel outside of London, and he went to the London newspapers with kind of a sob story of why won't my rich and famous Beatles son talk to me. And around this time, he hooked up with a producer and recorded a song, which I guess we might call a novelty record or a cash-in, called That's My Life, My Love, and My Home. And sure enough, it's very strange and very eerie and very odd. If you listen to this song, it actually has echoes of John's great anthem, Imagine.
Which wasn't going to be written for 6 years. So it may be the one thing that John got most of all from his father. Well, aside from, I guess, love of a music hall kind of music and the voice and the persona. Because you hear it in the Alfred Lennon song, yeah.
We'll hear the voice. It's more recital than singing. Freddie was no great shakes in the father department, and no great shakes in the vocal department either.
But listen to the chord structure of this. It's really freaky. Remember, this is the son. Well, I wouldn't say stealing from the father, but this is just so. Here's Alf Lennon from 1965, a song called "That's My Life." Anyway, that's pretty amazing stuff. That has got to be the biggest revelation so far in paging through Timothy English's book. Sounds Like Teen Spirit. There it is. So, what is the whole title there?
Sounds Like Teen Spirit, Stolen Melodies, Ripped Off Riffs, and the Secret History of Rock and Roll.
That Secret History of Rock and Roll. Amazing stuff. We only have a couple of minutes left now because I need to move on to other stuff. But I even want to play a couple of little quick Led Zeppelin-y things. Because, these are kind of shocking, too. Can you want to set one of these up real quick?
Whichever you have.
I'm not sure what the well, I'll play...
A Lot of Love?
Dig this. I think this is the Small Faces one. That is not Robert Plant. It's not early Led Zeppelin, even though it sort of sounds like them on their first album. Who is that?
That is Steve Marriott, the lead singer of the band The Small Faces. Extremely successful group in the UK. It included Kenny Jones on drums, Ian McLaughlin, and Ronnie Lane, all very talented guys, underrated and kind of underappreciated in this country with one or two exceptions. They had a couple of minor hits. The story behind this song is that it was written by the Chicago blues band Willie Dixon and popularized by Muddy Waters in the early 60s. The Small Faces version was, the original song was You Need Love. Their version was called You Need Lovin', I believe they did not properly credit it either. I believe they tried to take songwriting credit on themselves. Small Faces were a big band in England. Robert Plant was a huge fan of Steve Marriott.
Obviously, yeah.
And you can hear that, as a couple people pointed out to me. You can really hear in the vocals where he picked that up. On Led Zeppelin has their own chapter in the book, and they really have gotten in trouble. If you look at the credits on their first two or three or four, really four albums, I guess, maybe more, they're very different credits on those albums now than when they originally came out. When Whole Lotta Love came out on the second album, it was credited to Plant and Page. If you look at it on any of the recent CDs, it's credited to Plant, Page, and Dixon. The
reason for
that being, legal action was initiated on Willie Dixon's behalf in the 1980s, not too long before he died. Apparently, Willie Dixon was not aware of Whole Lotta Love but his daughter brought it to his attention, and legal action was taken, and is certainly a rightful, at least, co-author of Whole Lotta Love.
Obviously, yeah.
And in Jimmy Page's defense, tried to give both sides in the book.
Yeah.
He said, if you listen to, you know, the original Muddy Waters, or I guess you could say even the Small Faces, and then just the instrumentally, the Zeppelin version, are completely different pieces of music, and they are very different. And he said, well, you know, Robert Plant was supposed to change the vocal, change the lyrics on some of these, and he didn't do it, so apparently he found it okay to copy the music, but change the words around.
And he should have done a little bit more. Well, no, it's okay. You credit everybody, and everybody gets to share, and that's all right. You know, that, to me, that's a happy ending.
Yeah, they should have credited him, and there were a few other cases where they were, let's say, at least lax in their efforts to properly credit their sources. Their the song Dazed and Confused, which I touch on in the book, was really, there was another, the original song Dazed and Confused was by a New York songwriter, and the Yardbirds had done it and changed it around a little bit, but again, that's really not properly credited either as a Zeppelin track.
Now, the funniest one for me is, as we wrap this up here with Tim English, the author of Sounds Like Teen Spirit, this one is so cool, because I knew the fake, the copy, many, many years before I knew the original, because, you know, like all kids, I watched Saturday morning TV and the cartoons and stuff like that, including, I never watched H&R Puffin stuff, never got into that, couldn't deal with those weird people there. But I did watch another show called The Banana Splits, which was this completely ridiculous. I guess it was influenced by the Monkees. They tried to do a Monkees thing for kids. And it was these, you know, guys in monkey suits running around doing crazy things. And their theme song was really, really catchy. Well, what year was that? And what year was the song that you know, is going to blow our minds?
I'd say you're talking about 68, 69, I think, for the Banana Splits when it was on the air.
Uh-huh.
The Bob Marley song is on is from 1980.
So, wait a minute. So it was Marley who's the thief? Maybe he was stoned.
Well,
that's funny.
Oh, could it be? We don't want to ascribe motive, I don't think, but there's certainly the melody of the Banana Splits theme. I have this in a section of the book called Would You Believe, which is also where the Freddie Lennon, John Lennon Imagine case is. A very strange juxtapositions. But as somebody said to me, he says, we don't usually associate Bob Marley with grown men running around in animal costumes.
Well, we sure do now.
Yeah.
Let's go out with this, because we've only got a few minutes left on the show, let alone this segment. So here is going to be, well, we'll hear the Bob Marley first. And the funny thing is, it's this children's song that he cribbed from. And meanwhile, he's written this really, really serious song using the same kind of catchy music as the chorus. But before we play it, I want to thank so much to Timothy English for being a guest in the neighborhood and telling us and sharing with us all these music and all these homages. I'll put a nice word on it. Here tonight.
That's a nice way to say it, and I think any of your listeners out there that are into rock and roll, it's kind of a new way of looking at the whole history of music and getting some insight into the creative process and who influenced who down the years.
Well, go figure. Bob Marley being influenced by a bunch of guys in banana suits. Doesn't get better than that, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Dave.